Hello, welcome to Biology on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stouter speaking to you from beautiful Dania Beach. Beautiful day today. There's my feet in the sand and my notes in front of me. Hear a little bit of the ocean waves in the background there. And we're going to be speaking about biology today, as is fitting, given it's Biology on the Beach. I'm going to start off with the study of life, and in the study of life we're going to be noticing that there is the fascinating and exciting world of general biology that awaits you. Now, why do we say fascinating? Well, it's fascinating because it's all about us, and it's about our world. It's exciting because it's exciting to learn new things, particularly new things that are going to be not only of interest, not only stimulate our thought, but also will be relevant to our day-to-day living. So, let's talk a little bit about me. I'm your instructor. I'm Dr. Leo B. Stouter. I'm a DC. That means I'm a doctor of chiropractic. I'm a reluctant scientist because I went to community college to become an English professor. So I took up poetry, philosophy, humanities. I got my associate's degree in fine arts, or in liberal arts, and I went to the community college because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. And it was right down the road from me. So I believe in community colleges. That may be the reason why I'm a tenured professor here at Broward College. Now then I went to the University of Michigan, as I said, to become a teacher. But along the way I decided that maybe there might be another calling, and that would be to maybe study science and become a doctor. So I got my Bachelor's of Science in Human Biology, specializing in human dissection, and then I finally got my Doctorate of Chiropractic degree, National University of Health Sciences, which is in Lombard, Illinois. At the time it was called the National College of Chiropractic. And I've been in private practice since 1982. I retired about 4 years ago. Now I teach full-time at BC. So that's a little bit about me. Now, if you'll please email me a little bit about you. I'd like to know what your hobbies are, what your plans for the future are, and a little bit of your background as well, a little bio of yourself. So send that to me, if you will. For now, let's get on to the fascinating and exciting world of general biology. First, we have a cartoon. He thinks a chiropractor is an Egyptian doctor. Because, of course, Cairo is in Egypt. The importance of biology is something that we should consider. I mean, biology is important because it's about us. A pediatrician from Memorial Hospital, who should remain nameless, nonetheless mentioned that most medical complaints stem from a knowledge of basic biology. So if you know basic biology, you're well on your way to understanding other sciences and well on the way of understanding yourself and how you work and how your world works. So even though it's a basic course, this basic biology, it still, nonetheless, is a course that will be of interest, and also, I think, will also benefit you in other ways. So just because it's basic doesn't mean that it's simplistic or that it's not of relevance in our world. Now let's speak briefly about science and the brain. Now we have two sides of our brain. Functionally speaking, we can sort of generalize and say that our left brain is for analysis, math, and science. Our right brain is for creativity, art, and poetry. We need to build a bridge between your two brains. Therefore, you need a learning strategy. Now, if we were to speak with a neurologist about these two brains, they may say, that's ridiculous, you need your whole brain to think. If you're going to analyze something, you need to be creatively thinking about that analysis, so you got to use your right brain. And if you're going to be doing any kind of poetry, you need to also use your analytical side of your brain, and that's true. All that is true, but there is a practical way of looking at this, and the practical way of looking at it is that your left brain is for analysis, math, and science, and that your right brain is for creativity, art, and poetry. So I was really on my right side of my brain for most of my education until I decided to go for the sciences, and then I was on my other side of my brain. point here is that most of the people that take general biology are taking it because it's a requirement. And now they find themselves in a science class. It may be better for you to have a learning strategy when you're in a more challenging course than when you're in a more course that's more on your side of the brain, if you will. So that's why I want to emphasize this learning strategy. And the learning strategy is all about trying to figure out what four areas of your learning style, what four areas are your learning style. And what are these four areas? First of all, it's visual. Next, it's oral, or how you listen. Reading and writing's next. And finally, is kinesthetic. Kinesthetic is going to be how you learn through feeling. A mechanic's a perfect example of a kinesthetic individual who learns by actually taking things apart. And then that's how they get their knowledge. So they actually go through a feeling aspect. Or another way also is that kinesthetics are going to be individuals that usually do have the capacity to really have a feeling for a subject. So what I would want you to do is to go to any kind of search engine and put in VARK, stands for visual, oral, reader, writer, and also kinesthetic. Put in VARK, and one of the first things that come up should be the VARK website. And take the test that they give you there to figure out what your learning styles are. And then you can tailor your learning of biology to the learning style that you have that's most prominent. Let's say that you're a visual. Well, if you're a visual, you want to review pictures of notes and textbooks. You want to attend the lab. You want to look at models. You may even want to buy the biology coloring book. If you're oral, then these podcasts are perfect for you. You can certainly listen to lectures. Listen to my lecture in a podcast. Also go and get into a study group. So actually form a study group so that this way then you'll be able to listen to others talking. If you're a writer, then you need to take detailed notes and maybe even learn a note method like the Cornell note method. And you need to read the textbook because you're a reader and a writer. Outline notes, outline the text. And if you're feeling, you've got to spend many hours in the open lab handling models. You definitely want to get a coloring book. You want to relate to the material. You want to get a feeling for it. So I encourage you to do the VARK. Now, let's get on to the study of biology, the scientific study of life. First of all, bio is Greek for life. And lology is Greek for study. Now, why does that? Logos means word or speech. I still don't get it. Well, bio means life, and then if you're going to be talking about life, then you're going to be talking about, they're going to be studying life. But how does the logos come into it? Well, if you think about ancient Greece, the way that they taught each other was the way that we usually do teach each other, and that is one professor stands up in front of a host of people and tells them the stuff. He is literally speaking. He is talking words. That's where the logos comes from. So that's how we got that. So we got biology, the study of life. So studying biology can help you deepen your perspective of life because you're going to know more of it, more about it. What you're up on, you're not going to be down on. We see life's unity through DNA. DNA is a unifying principle. All things have a genetic information. All living things have genetic information. So we can look at DNA as a genetic sort of unifier, if you will, throughout life. Speaking of life, what is life? Well, life has certain properties. You must have all these properties for something to be called living, for something to say, so we can say that that thing has life. It has to have cellular organization, has to have a form of metabolism, has to have homeostasis, reproduction, and also has to have a quality of heredity. So what does cellular organization mean? Well, it has to have a cell. And a cell is going to be a specific structure that we're going to talk about later. But it has to have a cell. If it doesn't have a cell, we can't consider it to be alive. And the cell must be organized. What does organized mean? It means that it must be able to work in concert with the other parts of that cell. Or each individual cell must work together with each other. There are some unicellular animals. They are only one cell big. That's how big they are, one cell, and that's it. You may have heard of Montezuma's Revenge. It's that diarrhea you get sometimes if you go into a foreign country. This Montezuma's Revenge is going to be really an amoeba. An amoeba is just a one-cell animal. But it's still organized. So we can say that the amoeba is alive and does have the quality of life. Now also, for something to be alive, it has to have metabolism. It must be able to capture and use energy and also raw materials. There's going to be two types of metabolism. Anabolism or catabolism. Now most people don't know that metabolism is broke up into these two portions. Most people just think of metabolism as something that somehow helps you lose weight or not. If you have a slow metabolism, then you gain weight. And if you have a fast one, then you would then lose weight. But really, if we look at the components, we see one, which is anabolism, which is a building up. And catabolism, which is a breaking down. So if you consider that something is building you up, you would gain weight, right? If something's breaking you down, you would lose weight. So to say that by increasing your metabolism, it's going to cause anabolism and catabolism to increase, and that's going to cause you to lose weight, doesn't make sense. What they're really saying is, if you have a good metabolism, then you have more catabolism, more breaking down. If you have a poor metabolism, you have more anabolism, or more building up. So really what you have is an imbalance in your metabolism, I guess would be the best way to look at that. So let's use an analogy to try to understand the difference between anabolism and catabolism, those two portions of metabolism. In anabolism, we have a building up. Catabolism, we have a breaking down. So this morning, if you had an egg, for instance, that egg contains protein. Protein contains amino acids. So if you were to break down protein, you would get its component parts, which are amino acids. So an amino acid put together with another amino acid, put together with another amino acid, put together with another amino acid, makes a protein. Now we are mostly protein. If you look at our skin, if you look at our hair, if you look at that seagull overhead, he's basically all protein. So we are protein. So if we are protein and we eat protein, what happens to the protein we eat? Well, it gets broken down through the process of catabolism. Protein gets broken down into amino acids. These amino acids then get absorbed in our body, and then it helps us to be rebuilt. So we use those amino acids to make our skin, our hair, our nails, and our teeth, and whatever else. So our protein is coming from what we have eaten. You've certainly heard the adage, you are what you eat. Well, just because you eat ham doesn't make you a pig. But it does happen that that protein will be broken down, and we will be using those component parts to build ourselves back up. So our egg then is broken down through the process of what? Catabolism. And then the component parts that were broken down are going to build up our body through the process of anabolism. Now we can also think of the catabolism sort of like a cannibalism. If we think of cannibalism, we know that a cannibal breaks down human flesh. So that's a way of remembering it. Also, if you think of two bunny rabbits together, a male and a female bunny, if you put a male and female bunny together, what do you soon have? Small little bunnies. They are two animals that come together that build up a family. So that would be a form of animalism. Now let's move to homeostasis. Homeostasis is a fundamental property of life because this is a balance. And we'll talk more about that. But homeo means same, and stasis means state. So it's the same state. It's a steady state. It's what allows us to sort of shiver if we're cold, to heat ourselves up. It's what allows us to sweat if we're too overheated. It allows us to maintain a balance. Now, reproduction is when DNA is going to be passed on. Reproduction can occur in really two ways. One way is the obvious way, when individuals have sex and they reproduce their species. They have kids. The other way that's not so obvious is in mitosis. In mitosis, we will be reproducing our own cells. As you know, your skin will slough off every day. That's because old cells are being sloughed off. New cells are coming underneath your skin to push up the old cells. So those new cells underneath are going through the process of mitosis. And mitosis is reproducing the DNA. So those cells are going to be the exact same cells that are on top, that are actually dying off. So we keep producing our cells through the process of mitosis. We'll talk about mitosis later on. And heredity. Heredity is actual DNA traits. What's a trait? It's what you got from your parents. If you are tall and your parents are tall, you got that your height from your parents. If you're short, you got your shortness from your parents. If you're black, if you're white, if you're Asian, you got all those qualities from your parents because they gave you their DNA. And we'll talk more about that as well. So when we look at homeostasis, we already said it's the same state. And if we maintain homeostasis, then we have health. It's not a problem to get out of balance, but if we do get in an imbalance in homeostasis, we call it disease. If we get out of that disease or go back to homeostasis, then we get healthy again. So sometimes we'll get a cold, so now we're out of homeostasis. Then a cold ends, and we get back to homeostasis. So we go from disease to health, or as we like to say, dis-ease. You are not at ease until you get back to ease, which would be homeostasis. Now, a total lack or failed homeostasis is going to be death. So picture a teeter-totter with one person on one side and one person on the other, and they both weigh 100 pounds. They're not going to go anywhere. You need one to weigh 120 and one to weigh 100 so that at least one side will go down and then they'll push the other one up. They'll be able to go back and forth. So 100 pounds on either side, homeostasis. 120 pounds on one side, there's that imbalance. That would be called dis-ease. Now, picture that there's nobody else on the other side of the teeter-totter, only one person on one side. So now you have a total lack of balance. That would be considered death. Another analogy. If we think of an airplane is off course most of the time that they are in the air. So if you're going from Detroit to Chicago, for instance, about 99% of the time, you're going to be off course. So you're going to be out of homeostasis, if you will, out of balance. But how do you ever get to your destination then if most of the time you're off course? Well, the pilot is expert at putting you back on course. So you go off course, you get sick. You go back on course, homeostasis. You go off course, you get sick. You go back on homeostasis. And this continues back and forth until ultimately you reach your goal, which is health. Or in this case, Chicago. But if you totally lose your ability to go back to homeostasis, then of course that can be an illness that could lead ultimately to death. So when we look at the idea of the properties of life, we want to ask the question about the human immunodeficiency virus, or the HIV virus. Is it living or is it non-living? Well, we see a picture of it in our notes, and we see that the outside of it has protein, the inside has sort of like a genetic material. So already we're looking at genetic material, and that's one of our criterion. Remember the properties of life. We have to have cellular organization. We have to have metabolism. Think of the HIV. Does it metabolize? Does it use energy? Does it use raw materials? Definitely it does that. Does it have homeostasis? Is it able to live? Yes, it's able to live in the human body. It's not able to live outside the human body for very long, but it's able to live in the human body for sure. Can it reproduce? Yes, it can reproduce by invading other cells. Particularly, this virus likes to invade the T cells of the body, which is the immune fighters. So it actually attacks the very system that could attack it. And also heredity. It does have heredity inside of it. If you look right inside of the cell itself, you'll see that there's RNA. It doesn't use DNA, but it does use RNA. So there is genetic material. So which one of the properties of life does the HIV violate, or does it violate any? And the answer is that it violates one of them. And what it violates is the cellular organization. As we look at the HIV diagram, we see that it really does not have the components that a cell would have. And because it lacks that, we have to say that it is non-living. Now, we'll talk more about what a cell has to have later on. But for now, just trust that it is non-living. And yet you say, it can cause so much destruction, this non-living thing. That's true. But remember that we're using a biological definition of this virus. And we're saying that it is non-living due to the fact that it lacks at least one of the qualities of the properties of life. So that would be the reason we would say that. Now, speaking of life, life has an organizational structure. It goes from the simplest to the most complex. If we put together a bunch of cells, which we said are the basic fundamentals of our life, put together a bunch of cells, we get tissues. A bunch of tissues put together, we can create an organ. A bunch of organs together, we can make a system. And a bunch of systems that are coordinated or that are organized, we call them organisms. So that's going to be the most complex. So we're going to go from the simplest cells to the most complex, the organisms. Now this would be a great question, wouldn't it, on a test? What is going from the simplest to the most complex? And you would say cells, tissues, organs, systems, or organism. Or I would ask it the opposite way. What's the most complex to the simplest? So this would be something that you might want to consider in your future, in your very near future, as far as a test question. So let's look at some cells, just so we can run through the organization of life. So let's say that we have a skin cell. We call this an epithelial cell. Okay, so epithelial cells will make what kind of tissue? Right? Skin. Skin, hair, nails, all these tissues will, the epithelial cells will make these tissues. These tissues then would be considered organs of the integumentary system. The integumentary system is the skin, hair, nails. So that would be like the one system. So let's take another cell. Let's say a muscle cell. Muscle cell would be part of like heart tissue. Heart tissue, of course, then would be, the organ would be the heart. And the system would be the cardiovascular system. So now we have two systems. We have the integumentary system, which is going to be the skin, hair, and nails. And we also have the cardiovascular system, which is going to be pushing around blood to supply the skin, hair, and nails. So those are two systems, and we could go on and on with the gastrointestinal system, with the nervous system, with all the other different systems, and if we coordinate them together, then we get an organism, because those systems have been organized. So that's the idea behind the organization of life. Now, in science, we have a process that we go through when we want to know something. And this is called the scientific process. So how scientists work are through inductive reasoning. Philosophers work through deductive reasoning. So let's talk about philosophers first with their deductive reasoning. If you have a heavy weight, let's say a book, and you have a lightweight, let's say a pen, and you drop them at exactly the same time, deductive reasoning would tell you that one's heavier, the book, and the other one's lighter, the pen, So probably the book will fall first, right? And that's just a deduction. Are you proving it? No, you're just saying it's obvious. I mean, you know, it's just obvious that, you know, if you drop a book and a pen, you know, the one that weighs the most is going to, you know, obviously be the one that's going to fall first. Inductive reasoning would be to use a scientific process, not have an opinion about what's going to happen, but rather you would do an experiment or go through the process of the scientific process. So scientists look at the world to understand how it works. They carefully examine each specific case with inductive reasoning, as Galileo did. Galileo is actually considered the father of modern science. Now, what is this inductive reasoning? This inductive reasoning is really what you would think of as far as a way for you to actually see or get results from experiments. So really it's got to do with experiments. So let's look at the scientific process. First of all, we start off with observation. An observation will lead us then to a hypothesis or a prediction. This prediction then will lead us to an experiment. That experiment then will bring us back to observation. So, let's say that we have an observation of a book and a pen being one weighing more than the other. The book weighing more, the pen weighing less. That's our observation. Our hypothesis is that the book will fall first because it weighs more, and the pen will fall later because it has less weight. The experiment then would be to drop the book and the pen at the same exact time, in the same exact level, so that you're dropping them both evenly, and you're dropping them both at the same time. That experiment then would give us a new observation. And our new observation would be book and pen fall at the same time, or the book falls before the pen. Now, if our observation is that the book falls first and that the pen falls, our hypothesis then is proven. We then would want to do the experiment again to have the same observation. So we do this process many times. If we did it many, many times, then our theory would be what we would get as a result. And our theory in this case would be that no matter what, a book will fall first and a lighter object will not. Or you'll say, a heavy object falls first and a light object falls after it. So that would be our theory. And our theory then could be given to any other scientist. They could do the process and it should always be reproducible. That's a basic premise that the scientific process is based on. The reproducibility of the universe. That's something you were to do in Chicago. If you do the same thing in Australia, in Perth, that would be the same exact result. So it doesn't matter where you are, that you can always reproduce this. So there's a fundamental principle behind the scientific method that, you know, things just don't go willy-nilly. Things are going to go according to the principle that there's the reproducibility in our universe. So when we look at theories and laws, remember from the scientific process we got a theory. A theory is something that can be changed. A law is something that cannot be changed. Like the law of gravity on Earth. The law of gravity is not going to change. A theory, however, can. In the old days we had this theory that body got sick because the humors, or the fluid that flows in the bodies, in our body, was somehow upset, was somehow in balance, was somehow in a lack of homeostasis. And how do we get these fluids flowing again? Well, a variety of things. You could give a person a emetic so that they throw up. And that fluid that comes out would then be expelled, and then that would help to balance the body. You could give something that would cause diarrhea or a laxative to get rid of that fluid that way. Or you could blood let. You can actually open up a vein and bring out some of the bad blood, if you will. So if you were sick because your humors were in balance, we'd call that you were in ill humor. So we even use that term today. If you're sick, we say that you are ill. If you feel good and you're laughing, then you're humorous. So your humors are in balance. So we even have these terms today that we still use. But we know that this theory of bloodletting is improper. In fact, that's how our first president of the United States died. He was actually bled to death by his physician. So we know that this is a theory that has to give way. Now, there are no absolute truths in science, only varying degrees of uncertainty. The way a scientist works is that he usually never says, "Oh, eureka, I got it." Rather, what he will say is, "I know some things that don't work." Edison, when he was looking for the right filament for his light bulb, went through about 10,000 different filaments. And he tried different metals, and he tried different fibers from different trees, and he tried a bunch of different things that he could use to try to make the light bulb last. And nothing was working. So one time someone asked him, he said, you know, you have all these things that have not worked. You have so many failures. Aren't you upset by that?" And Edison said, "No, at least I know 10,000 things that don't work." And that's a typical scientific idea, is that we try to get closer to the truth by figuring out what is not true about something. So there's varying degrees of uncertainty, because we really don't, scientists will never really say, "Yeah, we definitely know this for sure." And you see this all the time. If you're, listening to the news, they'll say, "Well, this is really exciting research, but it's not definitive. We still need more research." I mean, they put that into research papers all the time, because we have varying degrees of certainty. So what I want to encourage you to do is to do the scientific method at home. Take a pen, take a book, drop them at the same time. Try not to have any errors in this book experiment. The possibilities for error could be sampling error. If you just drop the book one, two, or three times, there might be a sampling error because you didn't do it enough. Sometimes you'll see experiments that will be in the news, and then they'll say, they took 200 people and they did this or that and that, found this and that and that. You go, "Well, there's a sampling error right there, because 200 people does not represent the whole population of the world, or of one state, for instance." So a sampling error. Also make sure that you're not biased when you do your experiment. What does that mean? Don't have an opinion on what's supposed to happen. Just drop the book and the pen at the same time, at the same level, and see what happens. Just make an observation. Don't have a bias. Don't go, "Oh, I think they're going to drop at the same time," or "I think definitely the pen's lighter. Maybe the lighter means it's going to fall first." Or the book is heavier, but still, there's more wind around a book. Maybe it would decrease it. So don't have any kind of opinion. Don't be biased. Can't have a bias when you're doing experiments, because you're not after proving yourself. You're after what is the truth. You're trying to get as close to the truth as you can. On this idea of observation, you're going to be looking at your experiment and seeing what happens when you drop the pen and the book at the same exact time. We all know about optical illusions. We've all seen the optical illusions of, like, where we have, like, it looks like two faces and it looks like two vases together, or one vase and two faces. We've all seen these. So we know that our eyes can play tricks on us sometimes. So observation is an inherent flaw in most experiments, and that's why we try to tried to mitigate that. And one way of doing that in this experiment might be that you might have a friend with you looking right at the desktop as you drop the book. That and not he doesn't even know what he's looking for. You're just going to ask him a simple question, did they fall at the same time? Another could be an experimental design flaw. Do we have a control group here? Is there a standard for comparison when we drop the book and the pen? Not really. But if we were doing a drug study, for instance, we would want a group that was part of the study that did not get the drug. That would be called a control group. If they got better, and the people that took the drug also got better, then you have to say, well, the drug didn't do anything, because if they didn't even take it, you get better. So that's where the experimental group comes in. The experimental group is going to be the one that's going to be taking the drug, but they're going to be compared to the control group. So for us to really do this experiment with a control or experimental group, we'd really have to have two separate groups. But that's not necessary for our experiment here. And also the book experiment, we should have it being blinded. That means we should have all participants not even knowing what they're doing. You know what you're trying to accomplish. You're trying to see whether or not the book's going to fall first or the pen, or are they going to fall at the same time. But for to do a true experiment, it should be blinded. You should just have one person just drop the book. In other words, you should just take a friend, say, come here, do me a favor, just hold these at the same level and then drop them. And then have someone else who doesn't know what's going on either to just observe who falls first or who falls second or who falls at the same time. That way then it would be a blind experiment. And all you would do is just take the data and try to make sense out of it. That's really a way for the experiment to be perfect. So I encourage you to do the book and the pen experiment and email me with what you've discovered. Now, using science to make decisions. Science does not discover truth, but rather it discovers falsehood. The more that you don't know, the more you get closer to what you do know. Like, for instance, you really don't know someone until you know what they're not. If you go out with somebody and you know that they are clean and neat, but then you get in their car and you see that there's all this crud all over the car, you know for sure he doesn't keep his car well. Does that mean that maybe later on he won't keep himself well? So you really don't know someone until you know what they're not. And still, you don't really know them. So an excellent example is this puzzler. So please read through the puzzler and notice that the idea here is that you find out the answer to the puzzle by finding out what the individual is not wearing. So it's an excellent example of how the scientific process works. And then we have limitations of science. Remember that it's based on observations, so we talked about optical illusions. It's also based on the theory of the reproducibility of the universe, and we mentioned this also. But in quantum mechanics, for instance, when we go into an atomic world, in our atomic world, we see that experiments that are even observed will change because of the energy that you put into it as you just observe it. So this is a subatomic world that has different rules that don't really use the reproducibility of the universe. And that's exciting, but we're in the Newtonian world, and that's what we'll be talking about in this course. And Newton is all about gravity and reproducibility of the universe. So just keep in mind, though, that that's the underpinning belief, if you will, behind all science. And also, the limitations of science are that we tend to get into certain popular beliefs, like that cholesterol causes heart disease. Maybe that there's other things that are more important, like homocysteine, for instance, as we'll talk about in our last chapter. So we don't want our popular beliefs to restrict us. Remember that bloodletting was a popular belief in the old days. Well, now we know it's bogus. The external world, not internal convictions, must be the testing ground for scientific belief. We don't want internal convictions, we don't want internal beliefs to color our scientific beliefs. Some major unifying principles of biology are, first of all, the self theory, second of all, evolution, genes, homeostasis, and energy. These are unifying principles of biology. Now, what do we mean by cell theory? Well, we mentioned that the cell is going to be the basic unit of all life. So that's going to be our cell theory. The antithesis to the cell theory would be when we talked about, oh, we didn't talk about it, but if you think of Frankenstein, that would be the antithesis, that life can come from non-living things. So the cell theory is that one cell begets another cell. So two people come together and have a kid. So those cells and those two individuals came together to have that one child. So it's the cell theory. And evolution is not necessarily what you might think of. It's a fact that things tend to evolve anyways, not necessarily according to Darwin, but rather things evolve, things change, things, well, like for instance, energy can't be made or destroyed. That can be a way of looking at evolution, is that it evolves. It doesn't necessarily stay the same. Energy will change form. So that would be a form of evolution. And genes are going to be a unifying principle because genetics is going to be that one aspect that we mentioned even before that is going to unify and unify all life because we all share a genetic heritage. And homeostasis, as we already identified, is a very important point in biology because it's the fundamental of life, isn't it? And also energy. Energy is another unifying principle of biology because energy is what sort of fuels life. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about ATP. And we'll talk to you again in another Biology on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stauder. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye now.